funding for anti-hunger initiatives in places like East Africa, where tens of millions of people are facing famine amid a historic drought, Sirinen said that governments must stop making empty promises or creating more bureaucratic processes. Instead, they need to invest in small-scale food producers and food workers, she argued. They need to repurpose global agriculture and food system to better serve the health of the people, our planet, and our economies. Sirinen added, Western governments must also free up resources, including by taxing food companies and billionaires in order to invest in diverse, local, sustainable food production that helps countries to become less dependent on food imports and support smallholder food producers, especially women.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. As you know, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that will affect the governments, communities, organizations, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss how the film industry in Pakistan has degenerated owing to the overwhelming influence of Bollywood and Hollywood. And we shall also take a look at the history of cinema in Pakistan, its ebbs and flows, how it lost talent to Bangladesh, and how political tensions with India affected filmmaking.
Pakistan's beleaguered film industry is desperately looking for a fresh lease of life, but the struggle seems to be real. Despite great expectations, the South Asian country's cinema has failed to live up to its massive potential, mostly mimicking Bollywood and Hollywood. Instead of churning out films in line with the country's rich socio-cultural values and traditions, as well as themes people can relate to, the Pakistani cinema industry, known as Lollywood, has settled to being a rehashed version of overseas cinema.
The Pakistani cinema industry, now approaching 75 years of its existence, is still struggling to carve a niche for itself in the global entertainment sector. The reasons are plenty, but analysts mainly point to Lollywood being overshadowed by Bollywood and Hollywood, lack of technology, unimaginative screenwriting, and dwindling number of theaters in the country. The Pakistani film industry has failed to evolve on its own. In order to compete with its international counterparts, Lollywood has lost that Eastern touch to it. A top Pakistani actor, Hamza A. Abbasi, a few years ago lamented the impact that the Indian film industry has had in Pakistan and how filmmakers in Pakistan copy Bollywood.
Well, right now Indian cinema is hit in Pakistan. And I know I can't do it better than them. I can't make Dabang 3. They have bigger budgets. So we have stories. We don't depend on the masala.
Some Pakistani filmmakers have in the past expressed fears of the Indian film industry smothering the Pakistani cinema and damaging the country's Islamic culture and norms. The fact that some private channels in Pakistan distribute and promote Indian films illegally has also incurred huge losses to Pakistani filmmakers. However, it wasn't like this always. Before the 1980s, Pakistan had a thriving film industry and films didn't copy India or the West. The themes were in line with the country's rich cultural ethos. Then the decline began. followed by the slow death, which gradually opened the floodgates for Bollywood and Hollywood in Pakistan.
We could talk about the uplifting or further developing or improving the declining situation if we could think about the national solidarity or unanimity or something like that. And then everybody has to talk about they have their social freedom, maybe their national rights or statutory rights, whatever it is. But again, there has to be a policy for the national identity, for the sake of the national representative, and it's into the media. So this is what we are saying, is that what we can see, that there is a lack of development. There is no chance of development unless there is some point where a substantiating or sufficient policymaking is there.
After the Indian Army's airstrike in a tribal belt of Pakistan in early 2019, which led to heightened tensions between the two strange neighbors, Indian films were quickly pulled out of cinemas in Pakistan. For the past 3 years, Pakistani cinema has struggled to fill the vacuum. To make up for the loss, Pakistani filmmakers have tried to replicate the formula of Indian and Western cinema based on so-called liberal themes. As a result, the new films coming out from Pakistan have faced intense scrutiny for promoting wrong values and culture.
In an indication of how Bollywood and Hollywood have overshadowed Pakistan's ailing film industry, the Muslim-majority country's filmmakers have been trying to use the ingredients of Indian and Western cinema to churn out new Lollywood movies. In India and the U.S., which together account for an overwhelming majority of films produced globally, the so-called liberal themes, promoting vulgarity, immorality, and sleaze, dominate the New Age cinema. Instead of reviving their own traditions and customs through films and creative art, Pakistani filmmakers appear to have fallen into a vicious trap. Former Pakistani Premier Imran Khan had expressed his misgivings over the growing trend of vulgarity dished out by Hollywood Bollywood, laying stress on the cinema that promotes Islamic values and teachings. He even instructed his special assistant to work on a blueprint to revive the country's film industry away from the ominous shadows of Bollywood and Hollywood. However, the juggernaut rolls on.
This is a very well understood that Imran Khan was one of the great politicians in the history of Pakistan. He's still, and no wonder he can come back and take the office. However, he's concerned about the copying Hollywood or Bollywood. It has many many meanings. We could interpret into many directions. For example, Imran Khan was against the production of the blind following of Hollywood or Bollywood, because there are some differences definitely at the national level, at the international level, which that make Pakistani audience as well as the Pakistani media quite identical as compared to the other film industries, for example, Bollywood or Hollywood. They have their own standards, they have their own policies, they have their own ways and methods, and they have their own cultures and ethnic standards, maybe, whatever. But that's Imran Khan's meaning, was that Pakistani film industry has to develop its own identity into this competitive profession.
More recently, a Pakistani film, Joyland, which became the country's first ever entry at the Cannes Film Festival, appeared to glorify the transgender culture, much to the chagrin of Pakistan's majority Muslim population and clergy. The controversial film has rekindled the debate over the decay of Pakistani cinema.
The partition of the Indian subcontinent in 1947, besides spawning the worst humanitarian disaster, tremendously altered the landscape of film industries in the two countries. While India lost some great talent, Pakistan had to build the industry from scratch. With a strong foundation, the Indian film industry took giant strides over the years. Pakistani cinema, on the other hand, took smaller but measured steps. Quite remarkably, though, political tensions between the two countries had a ripple effect on their respective cinemas, too.
Following the partition of British India in 1947, filmmaking in the newly founded Pakistan suffered due to a lack of equipment and talent, as most noted artists and directors moved to India. In India, big cities such as Bombay, Calcutta, and Madras emerged as cinema hubs, but Pakistan only had Lahore as the major film center. The two major studios in the city were destroyed in the post-partition riots, leaving Pakistan's film industry without proper funding or specialized infrastructure.
From the partition in the year of 1947, we can see is that there was no, not any infrastructure available for Pakistan at national level to make films. So it took them 3 years to make a complete mechanism or a system to make movies. And then from 1950, all the way down to the late 70s, they made pretty good hits. You could say they were the good blockbusters. Even the neighboring countries they were following, and there have been at least 8 movies that have been made following by Pakistani cinema. The Pakistani cinema produced it, and they were remade into the Bollywood movies, at least 8, right? So till late 70s, the industry was flourishing, the people were performing, and the industry was growing. But because of General Zia's regime, who took the power, and as an army general who brought the martial law into effect, there came a complete halt into the any production of film industry because of his so-called Islamization.
Years after the independence, there was an attempt to ban Indian films in Pakistan to help the local film industry gain foothold and flourish. It didn't happen until 1965, when the second war between the two estranged neighbors prompted then-Pakistani military general Mohammad Ayub Khan to ban Indian films. More than 40 years later, in 2005, another military ruler, General Parvez Musharraf, lifted the ban. In 2019, India accused Pakistan of orchestrating a terrorist attack in Kashmir's Pulwama, which was followed by India's surgical strike inside Pakistan. It led to the reinstatement of the ban on Indian films in Pakistan. To fill the vacuum, Pakistani filmmakers quite imprudently started copying Bollywood, even at the risk of losing their own substance.
Comparatively, Pakistan and India are in the similar situation like England and America, with the same languages. England today can never make an Indiana Jones, but England still makes a Shakespeare in Love and get recognized. So we have the same chance. We will not be able to make a Dabang 2, but we will be able to make a Shakespeare in Love in the future.
Pakistan's film industry had a purple patch in the 1960s and 70s, when around 170 movies were produced annually, including color films. The number has nosedived to less than 20 a year now. Many experts attribute the downfall to the separation of East Pakistan, which later came to be known as Bangladesh, in March 1971. Bengali actors and directors were instrumental in the development of Pakistan's cinema. Apart from losing creative people and skilled technicians, the film industry in Pakistan was also deprived of a big market and production center.
The 1960s, which is widely regarded as the golden period of Pakistani cinema, recorded an impressive growth of films and film stars. During this period, the country's film industry opened up to local and international markets, reaping great dividends.
Today's filmmakers, since they're starting from scratch, they don't have any continuity with the old filmmakers, they're in a conflict. They don't know exactly what a good film these days would be in Pakistan. Should it be the old-fashioned social drama, with lots of masala and songs? Should it be just a comedy to distract people from what's happening in Pakistan? Or should it be a comment, a pointed comment on what's happening in Pakistan? So they're still searching exactly for the right formula. And it'll come. It'll come.
In 1971, almost 400 cinemas functioned across the country, a quarter of them in East Pakistan. A year before, 114 films alone were produced in what later came to be known as Bangladesh. The separation of East Pakistan in 1971 dealt a heavy blow to Pakistan's flourishing film industry. It took decades for it to recover, only to fall into the Bollywood trap. The cinema industry in Bangladesh also had to start from scratch. It did well in the beginning, but faced similar hurdles as Pakistan did after the 1947 partition. Over the past five decades, it has struggled for survival, prompting Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina in March this year to allocate a special fund for the revival of the country's film industry.
First of all, the government has to allocate some financial budget, the substantiating monetary support. This is the first thing. Second thing is they have to work for bringing in the latest technology into the industry, and then they have to introduce the well-qualified people, the directors and actors and whosoever takes it, the script writers, the storytellers, the plot setters, whatever it takes. They have to. We have to bring in the technology, like a computer, the graphic designers, the animators. It has to be a lot to bring everything together. And then what another important thing is that there has to be competitive benefits, the remuneration for the actors, the great, the talented people, so they can come, they, instead of going abroad and performing for other places, if they have great benefits right there in their, at their home ground, definitely it will make a huge difference.
Experts, however, have cautioned Bengali filmmakers not to fall into the Bollywood trap like Pakistan and risk losing its essence. For both neighbors, the mantra of success lies in charting their own journeys independent of Bollywood and Hollywood.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Shahid Khan, senior investigative journalist and documentary producer from London, UK. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Khan. Now, let's begin with why has Pakistan's film industry failed to live up to its potential despite its artistic talent, intelligence audience, and ample resources?
It's a huge historical perspective behind that. In fact, Pakistan. Film industry. My elder brothers were involved in film industry. I know very well. I know those directors, those who were well renowned as well, and they made some remarkable films as well. One, apart from my brother and his colleagues, I know one known as Zia Sarhadi. He was born in India but settled in Pakistan. Then later he had to leave Pakistan because of his talent. In fact, his write-ups and his films as well. Because of the martial law and dictators and all that. So similar story are like, for example, those who survived within Pakistan, they made some good film, feature film, but not very politically. If you touch political topics, then it's a problem. That's a basic issue of Pakistan industry falling up. Also, especially, I won't go far behind, but since 80s, when Ziaulhaq, the dictator who came in power, and during his era, the worst thing has happened because there was no Netflix or no digital options available at that time. Only cinemas were available. When you don't have any cinemas, or when you don't have any films coming in with the good write-ups or good direction or good actors, and the topics are not relevant to the reality. So the industry went down, and I saw many things. I spoke to many people about this topic as well, some actors and all that. The thing is, when Pakistan came into existence or Partition happened, many of the writers, directors, actors of that time, they are still icons, whether Riaz Shah, Iqbal Akhtar, whether Zia Saradi, or many others, actors Santosh, or you name it, so many were there. And they were making good films, and they were having good attraction for Indian market at that time. Even after that, another era came up during those when the biggest screen was summed up. Then the television screen, Pakistan television dramas were of way above than even Bollywood, the Bombay film industry, and they were even copying or following the songs and also the theme and also the stories in the films. That was the aspect. I was part of the South Asian television phenomena, which we brought into Europe. And at that time, the biggest attraction was Pakistan television dramas and writers. So we had the good writers, we had the good talent, but the political scenario was against these things. And also extremism came up. Also, the Afghan jihad, so-called, came up, and the mullah fanatics came up, and they wanted to close down everything which could have changed the society. So that was a major reason behind Pakistani film industry to go down.
Sir, former Pakistani Premier Imran Khan was a vocal critic of a Bollywoodization of the Pakistani film industry, which he blamed for promoting vulgarity and immorality. Now, do you think this concerns or his concerns were legitimate?
I don't take it 100%. The thing is, to support those fanatics or those close-mindedness or those people, those who were against these phenomena, to have their support, one has to address their issues in their way. So he was addressing, whereas he was very much known as a progressive and liberal person living in Western, but his reaction was not because he wanted to have those things. Those things will never change. The thing is, vulgarity is not because of vulgarity, is because other means, other problem, despite in Pakistan there are so many political Islamic organizations, but Pakistan society is deteriorating badly because of not having openness, not having proper knowledge or education. So they're not addressing the right issues, but these issues related with vulgarity or whatever Imran has said or he promoted, I think they were just to have the edge on political side from those people, those who are in fact controlling Pakistan, not majority, but they are controlling through establishment and all that. So it was just to promote their ideas, not to address the right issues. That's how I take it.
Last but not least, sir, what does the future hold for Lollywood, and how can it reclaim its lost glory?
Well, there's no doubt that we have wonderful writers. My personal friends, I'm a journalist, I'm into media, I'm in television, my family was in film. I'm part co-producer of this film, and also I'm engaged with many of the filmmakers and directors from Lollywood and Bollywood as well, for Pakistan, India, and other places, Bangladesh as well. But I do find it's difficult, even if we can make some film like Gulmakai, we cannot show it in Pakistan. We cannot address those issues which are good for the society. We cannot address those unless they make it okay. They are this establishment, unfortunately, holding not only politics, they are holding media, they are holding every aspect. You cannot get out of those things unless they agree to you. If they agree to anything, you can do everything. If they disagree to anything which is good, you cannot do anything. So unless those controls are not fading away, will not be able to grow or come out of this effect of Bollywood or even westernized film concepts. We have our own local concept and topics which we can address, and we can make good dramas, good films, good everything. But we are not there because of these unwanted controls.
There you have it, Mr. Shahid Khan, senior investigative journalist and documentary producer from London, UK. Thank you for your precious time and knowledge, sir. Now let's see what people have to say on social media.
Pakistani broadcast journalist Shifa Yousafzai cites former Premier Imran Khan as saying that Bollywood movies promote vulgarity and sexual abuse in Pakistan, which are not part of the country's culture. Mehwish Hayat, a Pakistani film and TV actress, says it's time for Pakistan's cinema industry to step up and counter the way it is shown in Hollywood and Bollywood, adding that they need films about Pakistan. A Pakistani-Canadian software developer, Harris Ahmed, writes to Pakistani actor and singer Ali Zafar, expressing hope that Pakistani cinema will create its own amazing genre, away from Bollywood and Hollywood. A Twitter user by the name Gustavo stresses that Pakistani cinema is on decline, adding that copy-pasting Bollywood is not working. Ikram Hussain, a Pakistani political activist, says the country must ban Bollywood and that local artists should be given incentives so that they promote their civilization.
And that was our episode about the downfall of Pakistan's film industry due to the unhealthy influence of Indian and Western cinema. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
U.S. House leaders' support for incumbent Democratic Congressman Henry Cuellar over progressive lawyer Jessica Cisneros in Texas elections have left progressives seething. We have prepared for you an article written by Joanne Grieve. The piece is titled Progressives Take Aim at U.S. Democratic Leadership Over Support for Centrist Candidates. Texas officials have still not declared the winner in the state's 28th congressional district, where incumbent Democratic Congressman Henry Cuellar currently leads progressive lawyer Jessica Cisneros by 175 votes out of roughly 45,000 ballots cast. But as progressives wait to see who will win the runoff race, they cannot help but think of what might have been if House Democratic leaders had not come to Cuellar's assistance. Henry Cuellar secured the endorsements of the top three U.S. House Democrats, and the congressman's campaign was also propped up by millions of dollars in super PAC spending aimed at attacking Jessica Cisneros. Progressives complained that House leaders' intervention in primaries like Henry Cuellar's is making it harder for their candidates to succeed, and they worry about the repercussions of the party embracing centrist candidates with controversial stances on issues like abortion rights and gun control. The potential victory of Henry Cuellar recently, who has previously received an A rating from the National Rifle Association, is all the more painful for progressives given the recent mass shooting incident at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas. The massacre, which unfolded roughly 100 miles away from Henry Cuellar's district, claimed the lives of 19 children and two teachers. Hours after the shooting last Tuesday, 24th of May, Progressive watched with dismay as Henry Queller crept ahead of Jessica Cisneros in the vote count. Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez vented her frustration at House leaders for aiding Henry Queller, attacking her colleague's policy positions and his potential involvement in an FBI investigation. Queller's home and campaign office were raided in January, but the congressman has denied wrongdoing, and his attorney claimed he was not the target of an investigation. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said on Twitter, "On the day of a mass shooting and weeks after news of Roe, Democratic Party leadership rallied for a pro-NRA anti-choice incumbent under investigation in a close primary. Robocalls, fundraisers, all of it." Adding, "Accountability isn't partisan. This was an utter failure of leadership." Progressives see a pattern in how party leaders and centre-left groups are targeting their candidates in primaries. In Pennsylvania's 12th congressional district, super PACs spent millions of dollars trying to prevent the nomination of State Representative Summer Lee, although the progressive lawmaker ultimately won her primary. Democratic Congressman Kurt Schrader, who had attracted criticism for blocking key parts of Joe Biden's agenda, still won the president's endorsement and secured the backing of House Democrats' campaign arm, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. Kurt Schrader officially lost his primary to progressive challenger Jamie McLeod Skinner on Friday, 27th of May. Progressives argue that Jessica Cisneros would have easily cruised to victory as well if the Democratic establishment, particularly House leaders, had not invested so heavily to assist Henry Queller. In the weeks leading up to Tuesday's election, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi recorded a robocall for Henry Queller, while Majority Whip Jim Clyburn traveled to Texas to campaign alongside his colleague. Waleed Shaheed, communications director for the progressive group Justice Democrats, said, "With a margin this small, it's clear that a pro-choice, anti-NRA Democrat could have easily won if it wasn't for the full-throated support of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and the party establishment in Washington for anti-choice, pro-NRA Henry Queller." Waleed Shaheed added, "Why is all of Democratic Party leadership more heavily focused on defeating an anti-NRA, pro-choice Democrat than defeating Republicans in the midterm elections?" But allies of House leader Nancy Pelosi and Majority Whip Jim Clyburn see nothing nefarious in their actions to help candidates like Henry Queller, given that endorsing incumbents has long been a standard practice for party leaders. Antoine Seawright, a Democratic strategist who serves as a senior advisor to the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, claimed House leader's strategy was practical as the party attempts to hold on to its narrow majority in the chamber. Republicans only need to flip a handful of seats to regain control of the House, and they're heavily favored to do so, given historical trends and President Biden's underwater approval rating. Antoine Seawright said, "At the end of the day, it's about 218. That's the number of votes needed on any given day to get anything done. This is all about preserving and keeping the majority." The shifting politics of Henry Queller's district also adds more complexity to the race. Texas's 28th congressional district, which covers the eastern outskirts of San Antonio and stretches down to the U.S.-Mexico border, was previously considered a Democratic stronghold. but the district has become more conservative in recent years, and election forecasters consider it to be a toss-up race for November. With a difficult general election ahead, some Democrats say a more conservative member of the party, like Henry Queller, who has held the seat since 2005, may have a better chance at winning. Antoine Seabright said, "Mr. Queller has been re-elected on many occasions in that district, and I think that means that the voters of that district, Democrats, Republicans and Independents alike, have made the decision that he's a person they want representing their interests in Washington." But supporters of Jessica Cisneros' campaign take issue with that argument. Ezra Olive Lieberman, the electoral organizer in Texas's 28th congressional district for the climate group Sunrise Movement, said Jessica Cisneros would be the stronger candidate in the general election because of her ability to energize and mobilize young voters. Since Sunrise endorsed Cisneros last year, the group has made more than 700,000 calls to support her campaign. Ezra Olive Lieberman said, "We've been knocking doors in 100-degree Texas heat because we're excited about and inspired by the vision that Jessica Cisneros is fighting for that says we don't have to live in fear of gun violence, that we can have freedom to make decisions about our own bodies." Looking ahead to the general election, Ezra Olive Lieberman added, "It's going to be hard and we need a grassroots base to win. And I think Democratic leadership is squandering any hope of us winning by alienating young people." Ezra Olive Lieberman noted that young voters helped elect Joe Biden and secure the party's majorities in Congress, and he accused House Democratic leaders of ignoring the needs of a key constituency. Olive Lieberman said, "It's so abundantly clear what young people want and how Democratic leadership is willing to do the exact opposite. I feel really angry that we have put so much into fighting for a better world and to try to put a stop to so many of the crises that we're facing. And it feels like the people who are standing in the way of that are people who supposedly are on our side." Olive Lieberman and Jessica Cisneros' other supporters have said they will fight to get every vote counted in Texas's 28th congressional district, expressing hope that Henry Queller can still be defeated. But regardless of the outcome in Texas, progressives are encouraged by the victories they have already seen in primaries this year with candidates like Lee and McLeod Skinner. They are ready to keep up the fight, even if Democratic leaders attempt to stand in their way. Ezra Olive Lieberman said, "If anything, I think this primary season so far is just emboldening our movement to build more power, to keep going to get stronger." He added, "And we know that the establishment is scared."
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The United Nations has warned the Israeli regime against forcible mass eviction of over 1,000 Palestinians from their homes in the Masafer Yatta area of the occupied West Bank.
Evictions that will lead to displacement, if enforced, amount to forced deportation and a grave breach of the Fourth Geneva Convention, and therefore constitute a war crime.
The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs added that the international humanitarian law imposes an absolute prohibition on the forcible transfer of civilians from or within the occupied Palestinian territories, and that Israeli authorities must put an end to all coercive measures, including planned evictions, demolitions, and military training in it.
Well, the Palestinians have been periodically rising up against this ongoing slow-motion Zionist genocide. It's been going on now. The Palestinians have been resisting this genocide for more than a century since it began, when these settlers started swarming into Palestine against the wishes of the Palestinian people. And so that struggle will, of course, continue. And there will be continuing protests. There are basically ongoing peaceful protests in Palestine. And every now and then, the uprising becomes more of a military nature. And then, of course, the Zionists respond in kind, and all kinds of blood is shed. At the end of the day, the Zionists are continuing their slow-motion genocide, but it isn't happening fast enough to save them. In the long run, the Zionist entity is doomed because it hasn't been able to get the actual acquiescence of the Palestinians, first and foremost, and then secondarily, the people of the region.
A ruling by the Israeli Supreme Court on May 4th allowed for the mass eviction of Palestinians in the area. The Israeli military has designated part of the area as a closed military zone for training, and the regime has sought to remove the communities on the spaces. The European ambassador to the occupied Palestinian territories has warned against Israel's planned evictions.
If mass evictions and forcible transfer were to be the case, that would be the biggest forcible transfer for decades.
The official added that the EU hopes that upcoming visits of US President Joe Biden to Israel would put pressure on Israel to fulfill its obligations to protect civilians.
The US could stop Israel from all of its crimes if it absolutely turned and chose that path, but it won't. And the reason, of course, is that there's a lot of Zionist power here in the United States, including in the Biden administration. And they're sending a message by saying, even when Biden goes to the Middle East, and it would be in his interest and the American interest to have the Israelis modify their behavior, they won't do it. They don't need to do it. They're thumbing their nose at the world. And the Zionists have a long track record of things like this. They never compromise. They never try to go the extra mile to be reasonable.
Although the United States has called on the Israeli regime to stop its settlement drive, but in effect it has supported the regime in its crimes against Palestinians. U.S. officials have repeatedly hailed Washington's unwavering support for the regime. They have also turned a deaf ear to growing cries from various international organizations regarding the regime's atrocities. The United States has also vetoed numerous resolutions in the UN Security Council that criticize the regime.
Amid ongoing diplomatic efforts to revive the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, the U.S. has introduced fresh sanctions against Iran. Washington claims the measures target an international network of individuals and entities that allegedly facilitated the sale of Iranian petroleum and petrochemical products to East Asia. The move comes ahead of President Biden's visit to the region next week. Last week, Iran held high-stake diplomatic talks in the Qatari capital, Doha, to restore the JCPOA, with the EU coordinator, Enrique Mora, shuttling between Iran's top negotiator, Ali Bagherikani, and Robert Malley, the U.S. Special Envoy for Iran. Following the talks, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian rejected claims made by U.S. officials about new demands raised by the Iranian delegation in the Doha talks, saying the Islamic Republic's requests are in line with the 2015 accord. He said, contrary to U.S. media claims, Tehran put forward no excessive demands that goes beyond the framework of the JCPOA.
برخلاف برخی ادعاهای رسانه‌ای طرف آمریکایی، ما هیچ گونه مطالبه زیاد خواهانه ای نداریم هیچ گونه مطالبه فرابرجامی مورد ادعای آمریکا را نداریم. مطالبات ما کاملا در چارچوب توافق سال 2015 است.
امیر عبداللهیان's remarks came in response to US special envoy for Iran Robert Malley, who claimed that Tehran came up with new demands at the Doha talks. The US State Department spokesman Ned Price echoed Malley's remarks, claiming that Iran has consistently introduced extraneous demands, demands that or issues that go beyond the four walls of the JCPOA. Iran is pursuing the JCPOA talks while Israel has been sounding the alarm about Iran, its regional influence, and its alleged efforts of weaponizing its nuclear program.
And Israel is far from wanting the interests of the countries of the region. On the other hand, we see that the countries in the region like Iran, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Jordan, they're talking to each other, they're meeting in Baghdad. They've met several times in Arab and Middle Eastern capitals, so they are capable of sorting out their problems. And therefore, any relationship with Israel would be detrimental and against the interest of the countries of the Middle East.
Meanwhile, a top Iranian security official has warned against forming alliances with Israel, saying that such moves endanger the security of the region. Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, says that any alliance with the Israeli regime, even of a non-security and non-military nature, will pose serious threats to the stability and security of the Middle East region. Shamkhani made the remarks in a meeting with the visiting Qatari Deputy Prime Minister and Minister of Foreign Affairs, Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman Al Thani, in Tehran. He underlined the emphasis on neighboring countries in the Islamic Republic's foreign policy, asserting that Tehran's coherent policy towards its neighbors is to expand all-out and strategic relations on the principle of good neighborliness. Separately, Shamkhani warned that the Islamic Republic opposes any move that changes regional geopolitics. This was in reference to a so-called Arab NATO, a plan that was a non-starter when it was introduced by the former U.S. President Donald Trump. This military regional alliance was due to Israel and the U.S. sounding the alarm over the perceived threat coming from Iran.
The Iranophobia is something very natural to happen in the West because it is one of the U.S. tools against a country like Iran, like Russia, who refused to submit to the U.S. hegemony.
Iran has rejected such a notion and has said that through regional cooperation, security can be established. Iran believes that Israel and the presence of foreign forces are the source of instability. The UK Prime Minister fought as hard as he could, but he finally gave in. Boris Johnson has resigned as the Conservative Party leader. This will pave the way for a successor to replace him as the British Prime Minister, after over 50 of his ministers quit the government. He will, however, continue as Prime Minister until autumn. A Tory leadership race will take place this summer, and the winner will replace Johnson by October. Boris Johnson's premiership plunged into crisis following the dramatic resignations of Chancellor Rishi Sunak and the Health Secretary Sajid Javid. Javid, who served as the Secretary of State for Health and Social Care, made reference to Johnson's failed leadership as the reason for quitting his post.
And now this week again, we have reason to question the truth and integrity of what we've all been told. And at some point, we have to conclude that enough is enough. Yeah. I believe that point is now.
Further resignations have followed, with the education ministers Will Quince and Robin Walker and ministerial aide Laura Trott quitting.
He had scandal after scandal, miscalculation after miscalculation. He's lost the confidence of, I assume, the country, going by the recent by-election results, and more recently he's lost the confidence of many senior members of his government, with over 40 of them now resigning.
Johnson was under mounting pressure after apologizing for appointing MP Christopher Pincher to a role involved in offering pastoral care to his party, even after being briefed that the politician had been the subject of complaints about sexual misconduct.
He knew the accused minister
had previously committed predatory behaviour, but he promoted him to a position of power anyway. Why?
They're looking at the future. They're looking at the next Conservative government being returned in 2024. I believe they feel that won't happen with Boris Johnson at the helm. Therefore, people are jockeying for position. The knives are out. It's a Caesar and Brutus type political ending of his career.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson and the scandals that surrounded him drowned his political life, and he found himself to have fallen out of favor with the general public in the UK. Prior to his resignation, a snap YouGov poll had found that 69% of Britons thought that Johnson should step down as Prime Minister. The timing of his resignation could not be any worse. The UK is experiencing a cost of living crisis like no other time in its history. Many Britons are struggling to cope with rising fuel and food prices. Economists say that the country is now heading for a sharp slowdown or possibly a recession.
He is, for his own political, selfish purposes, been running this country's economy into the ground, and worse, far worse, he has been threatening a peace process. That's all I've got to say.
And things will get much, much worse before the next general election. And I think regardless of who wins that election, we will continue to see an economic crisis.
Now with a new administration set to take the helm in September or in early October, the real concern for the UK is how it will cope with the economic crisis until then. This is not to dismiss the fact that there are no guarantees that the new administration will be able to deal with the economic onslaught that will be piled on it.
I'm sickened myself and furious about that.
The International Federation of Journalists, or IFJ, says the Federation will be a partner in the lawsuit filed against the Israeli occupation in the International Criminal Court. A member of the executive board of the Federation says the move came after the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate succeeded in persuading the Federation to file a lawsuit against Israel in the International Criminal Court. IFJ stated that the filing comes in light of the Israeli aggression against Palestinian journalists and people. Earlier, the Journalist Syndicate had said that it succeeded in exposing Israel's acts of aggression against media professionals and the Palestinian people. The circumstances of Shirin Abu Akleh's killing on May the 11th have been investigated by several international organizations. All concluded that it was a bullet fired from an Israeli rifle that killed the Al Jazeera correspondent and injured her fellow journalist as they covered an Israeli raid in Jenin. Multiple witnesses also agreed with the probes, stating that Israeli forces shot the veteran Palestinian reporter. Meanwhile, Al Jazeera and its host country Qatar pointed the finger at Israel from the outset. But the question is, will there and can there be accountability for the crimes committed by Israel?
And the absence of punishment shows hypocrisy, double standards, and deception and lies. So this is an opportunity for journalists to present all of the best documented evidence, research, discovery that they've done about crimes against humanity that the Israeli apartheid regime has committed. And the more international they go, the louder they go, the more they invite other countries to be participants, to join the lawsuit against Israel, the more you're building international consensus in support of the people who have been violated, dehumanized, killed, robbed, or in other way injured by this grotesque apartheid Israeli policy and agenda of genocide, bigotry, and destruction. So it's a very essential step, and I'm glad they're taking it.
Earlier this month, Palestinian officials handed over to U.S. forensic experts the bullet that killed Abu Akleh. But despite all the evidence pointing fingers towards Israel, the U.S. said it could not reach a definitive conclusion on the origin of the bullet. Meanwhile, Abu Akleh's family have expressed their anger over the U.S.'s disregard for what several courts and rights organizations have stated and its failure to accept that its ally has murdered a journalist in broad daylight. The International Federation of Journalists, or IFJ, says that Israel was guilty of the crime and expressed deep disturbance over Israel's failure to conduct a probe into Palestinian journalist Abu Akleh's killing. The U.S., on the other hand, has not condemned this act, yet aside from saying there needs to be an independent investigation, raising questions about whether the U.S. is seeking the truth or to protect its ally.
Well, absolutely, the U.S. is guilty of supporting the regime. The U.S. is guilty from enabling the regime to engage in war crimes and crimes against humanity. The U.S. has been guilty of stealing money from the American people and giving it to the Israeli apartheid regime and giving them weapons and, in fact, looking the other way when Israel had developed nuclear weapons. But that's another story. But Israel's crimes and abuses against the Palestinians, against the Syrians, against Lebanon, against all sorts of countries and nations and peoples, the U.S. is the partner in crime that is responsible. And if the U.S. does not hold a moral standard and a very clear objectivity and a dedication to truth and justice, then the U.S. is showing that it has no dedication to truth and justice, but instead has a dedication to lies and crime.
The murder of Abu Akleh, which sparked global outrage, only adds to Israel's long list of atrocities against Palestinians. But that fury has yet to translate into any concrete measures, particularly by international bodies such as the UN Security Council. So far, several international organizations have provided evidence of Israel's brutality against Palestinians. UN resolutions have also been passed against Israel. Yet no one, including the United Nations Security Council, has used any of its tools to ensure its resolutions. Meanwhile, the International Criminal Court has ruled that it has a mandate to investigate the occupied territories and has accepted the Palestinians after they were granted non-member observer status at the UN. This comes despite Palestinians' inability to join the ICC, as Israel is not a member and Palestinians do not qualify as a sovereign state.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
With his criminal trial for contempt of Congress approaching, Stephen K. Bannon, an ally of former President Donald Trump who was involved in his plans to overturn the 2020 election, has informed the House committee investigating